The Gambling Files podcast presents Desert Island Discs with your host, John Bruford. Hello and welcome to Desert Island Discs. Sorry, The Gambling Files presents Desert Island Discs, just in case any lawyers are listening. My name is John Bruford, and I'm your host for this journey. The point of Desert Island Discs is it's not just to find out about people's favorite sweet treats, although that is part of it. It's talking to key figures in the gambling industry about what they would have on a tropical island if they were stranded to keep them sane. But realistically, that's a way of looking at the milestones and important things in their lives. So it's about their journey. So our guest gets to choose three albums, three books, three movies, one song, not on the albums, one pet from any point in their lives, one object, one dessert, and two pieces of advice, one from their older self to their younger self, and vice versa. So, today's guest, I need to begin with an apology because I got it badly wrong when we were supposed to record before. So, Charles, I'm sorry. Very pleased that you're here now. It's none other than Charles Cohen, founder of Department of Trust, among many other positions in the gambling industry. Charles, welcome.
Welcome. Thank you very much. You're lucky I forgave you for your absolute rudeness of not turning up last time. But it was okay because actually I really couldn't get my head around this list. This is a pretty tough assignment. So I'm glad for the extra time.
Seriously, it sounds so simple when I just read off a list like that. But every time I record one of these, I've got it in the back of my mind what mine would be. But every time I record one of these, it changes.
Yeah, it's hard, and it's a bit like picking your favorite child.
I know, it's easy with mine.
You've only got one.
No, I've got three.
Oh, you've got three? Okay, all right. All right, well, let's not go there.
Three, but just one favorite. No, they never listen to this podcast.
That's what you think.
No, they listened to the other one. I made the mistake of saying on The Gambling Files that it was really funny that the kids had believed me when I said I couldn't afford to get them bikes. And the next time I saw them, they were like, Dad.
Okay.
Rumbled.
All right.
So, Charles, you've for years, you've been my go-to guy for if I don't understand, this is going to sound terrible for me. If I don't understand something, I go to either Fintan, you, or Sarah Ramanauskas.
Okay. Well, I'm flattered to be in such esteemed company. They're both absolutely top smart people.
Yeah, pretty legendary, aren't they? But, you know, you're there on merit.
Well, thank you.
We usually kick off with three albums. So what I'm going to do is I'm not going to change things up. What's your first album? For this is your tropical island. Your basics are taken care of. You've got food, you've got shelter, except for desserts. You've got food, you've got shelter, water's taken care of.
Mm.
What's your first album?
My first album is Talk Talk, The Color of Spring.
Whoa. Okay, so I think we're probably about the same age. You might be a little bit younger than me. I'm not sure.
56.
Yeah, you're a tiny bit older than me, but I would have guessed around my
Botox.
Age.
Yeah,
I hear you.
No, yours, not mine. But okay.
But yeah, Talk Talk are one of those bands that. People that liked them back in the day are still passionate about them now. They're in you forever.
Yeah.
People are so, so passionate. So yeah, why this album?
So, you know, The thing about albums is that they kind of mark certain chapters in your life.
Yeah.
This one I was listening to in when I must have been doing my A levels. So I was in sixth form, and had it on, you know, cassette, and it was. It was really the first. I was never really into pop music. I mean, it was kind of nice, but I never really got into anything, right? And this was the first album that I really just kept listening to over and over and over again. There's something really quite profoundly brilliant about it. And then they went on to do these other quite extraordinary albums. I don't know if you've ever heard the later ones, Ascension Day and all these things, and that. I still listen to them, actually. I probably listen to it maybe at least once a month, if not more, because just, you know, it's just brilliant to sit there and let it wash over you. It's tremendous. And so I every time I listen to it, though, I'm kind of back in my Morris Minor sitting outside the car park at school thinking, why am I doing this? But it, yeah, fabulous piece of music and really genre defining. So there's a lot that came after it that couldn't have happened otherwise. They really were amazing because they started out, you know, they tried to make them into a kind of a regular pop band. That didn't really work. I mean, they had some hits, but Color of Spring, Life's What You Make It was just, you know, mind-blowing and still is. Incredible track.
They are one of those bands, Talk, that musicians especially love.
Yes, it's very nerdy. It's very nerdy. I'm not a musician. I wish I was, but people like you said, people get passionate about it, but it's in a really nerdy way.
Hey, it's your choice. I'm not I'm not dissing you with nerd
but I
talk.
I could, you know, if I'm stuck on this desert island for a long time, I could just listen to that on repeat and I'd be very happy.
It's Tropical Island, just in case any lawyers are listening.
Okay, Tropical Island.
Fabulous. And great,
I should have gone for Wham, then I could have had Club Tropicana on the album as well. How about that?
But you could have that as your song, couldn't you?
That's true. I could.
My thinking about the song choice was simply that somebody could want Eye of the Tiger by Survivor, but nobody in their right mind is going to choose a Survivor album.
That is true. It's a terrible album. That is true. Okay. Wow. All right. There you go.
So Survivor, continue to inspire even today. What's your next album?
Okay. So this is, I think, one of the greatest musical performances ever recorded. It is Keith Jarrett's Cologne 1975 concert.
You're going to have to talk me through this.
Okay, so
this is
Keith
all
Jarrett,
new to me.
Keith Jarrett, one of the greatest pianists of the 20th century, still going, amazingly. He must be about 100 by now. And he was really the guy who brought improvised jazz, classical fusion to the world, right? And he got, somebody's actually just made a film about this. He got to asked to go and do this concert in Cologne by someone who was a complete amateur producer who just loved Keith Jarrett and thought, wouldn't it be great to have him perform at this? There's an enormous concert hall in the city, and she had absolutely no idea what she was doing. And when they turned up, they found that the piano was broken, the pedal didn't work, it was the wrong piano. And anyway, it was a huge success. He sat down and they recorded it, and the most incredible thing about it, and you know, you have to listen to it once all the way through before this sinks in, is that it was all completely improvised. So it sounds like something that was rehearsed and rehearsed for hundreds of hours. And apparently, apart from some of the bits at the end, it was all completely made up on the spot.
That's wild.
And it just, I honestly, if anyone's listening to this and is thinking about what to add to playlist, just play this. It's extraordinary.
So I'm just looking up the album now. That's over an hour of improvisation.
Yep.
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
So there's like, I mean, I was also just reading that this is the biggest selling piano recording ever.
Very possibly. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, he's done some incredible stuff. Like he did Arvo Pärt's Tabula Rasa, which is would have been my fourth album if I was allowed to have four albums. So kind of like Keith Jarrett's Everywhere, and he's like, it's not as serious as Glenn Gould, who was around at the same time, was much, much more intense on classical music. It's the improvisation quality. It's amazing. You can't describe it. You just go listen to it, everybody, and then write to us and complain that we're talking nonsense, or tell us that we've changed your life.
I'm gonna go find it later.
Okay.
You just got me thinking, but this is kind of by the by, but there was an album that came out a few years ago by Lisa Coleman, a name that you might not be familiar with, because why would you be? Lisa Coleman is one half of Wendy and Lisa, which sounds like the chaviest pair of musicians in history, but they were actually a major part of the revolution, as in
Prince's band, yeah.
And Coleman released a solo album a few years ago, which is just all keyboard. And it was described as semi-improvised.
I'll look that up. That's great.
And it's really fabulous. There's something about the simplicity of just a keyboard or just a piano. There's a reason that such an incredibly old instrument is still used in popular music every day.
Right.
I think as animals, it hits a real emotional chord, no pun intended, inside us. I really do think that. And as Lisa Coleman got me thinking about that. So let's see what Keith Jarrett's got, shall we?
Okay.
Better be good.
Brilliant.
But the Lisa Coleman album, that's like 28 minutes or something like that. I'm going to give you a whole hour for this.
Okay. You won't regret it, I promise.
But the picture of Keith Jarrett I'm looking at on Wikipedia, he just looks cool.
Yeah.
He just looks like a cool human being.
He's astonishing. I mean, you know, he kind of repeats this trick in various European cities over the years. But the Cologne one is by far the best. In my personal, very unhumble view.
Hey, humility's overrated. What's your third album?
My third album is, I would like the complete set of Bach's sonatas and partitas for violin, which I think is must be about 40 pieces. From memory, maybe more. Lots of, you know, it gets cut up quite a lot, but there are a few really excellent recordings out there. In the days when you used to buy actual music, I had about five different recordings of this. And it's amazing how something that's so simple can be so different. The same notes played by different people. And, you know, kind of take your pick and which ones you like. But this music is... it just sort of speaks to you in a very, very profound way. The structure, I mean, anything that Bach writes, you know, structurally it's people talk about the maths of it and the beauty of it, but it's the perfect music. It really is. And it's simplicity, and the rhythm and the way that it works, and you just get carried along by it. And actually, you know, there's quite a lot of stuff you listen to today. It's actually that's just a Bach melody that's just they've just ripped off. But that's because he just wrote thousands and thousands of extraordinary tunes or pieces, and every single one of them is a piece of art in its own right. And anyway, people love the whole kind of the cello suites, you know, the Yo-Yo Mas of this world. And that's great. I love that. But if you like that, then listen to the violin stuff, because it will blow you away.
Well, hang on, I need to take a step back here. There's a question about the Keith Jarrett album that I didn't ask, and I'm sorry.
Okay.
How did you first encounter that record?
God, I don't remember. I really don't remember. A lot of my music discovery when I was at university, I had a room in the first year. I had a room above the music shop, the classical music shop. And basically, when I got my grant, the first thing I did was go downstairs and buy a pile of CDs. And there was a couple of people in there who would just say, okay, well, why don't you try this, this, and this? And of course, that was how you discovered music in those days. And so I listened to it then. And then I kind of didn't really listen to it again a lot until quite recently, actually, when I read about this movie that was coming out. And I thought, God, I haven't listened to that for a long time. And it just, it was just super fresh. Again, it got reissued, I think. And then it just, yeah, it's amazing. All my CDs went the way of all things, right? I mean, God knows what happened to them all.
Yeah, I know what happened to mine. Damn it. Got ruined in a leaky garage.
Yeah, actually, that happened to a lot of mine as well. And all my albums, my LPs.
Fucking don't. It's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
I'd never gotten rid of any of them.
No, it's true. So, yeah, that's how I came across it.
Bark. Like, this ties in with what you were just saying about how we used to discover music. And this isn't strictly speaking a Bark stuff, but I used to work in a bookshop in Shrewsbury. And it was in the basement of an old sort of hospital building.
Mm.
It was fucking freezing down there because it used to be the mortuary. It was absolutely freezing even in the summer. And there was a cassette player and a radio. And of course, the radio couldn't get anything. I was in the basement. And this is, I could still smoke at work then. And, you know, so this was a long time ago. But there were just a few cassettes there. And there was The Best of Van Morrison, which got quite boring quite fast. And that was how I discovered Mozart's piano concertos. Because mostly as a late teenager, I was listening to, you know, rock and indie. This was the early 90s. And I pretty much wore that. I think it was like Mozart piano concerto is like 21 to 23 or something. And I played the shit out of that thing. And that's exactly where I fell in love with classical music. And that's sort of maintained, but that brings me up to Bach.
Yes.
Because Sebastian. The lady who did the music that is the intro to this podcast and is the music that's the intro to the Gambling Files podcast is a musician named Mara Carlisle, right? Mm-hmm. Now, Mara is, I think she's a fucking genius. And she's somebody who brings contemporary and classical and bizarre, really strange influences into her music to create this new thing. Mm. And I think with your love of classical music, you might really appreciate her. She also plays the saw, which is a bit of a head fuck.
Okay.
But years ago, Mara's first album came out and I was meeting her for lunch and I think I was still living in London at the time. And we met on Oxford Street where the big HMV was.
It's still there. It's all, they've reopened it.
She said, have you got the album? I said, I've only got the, she sent me a pre-release CD.
Mm.
So I've only got the one that you sent me, which has got like a song on it that never made the final album. Which is a shame because the song that didn't make the final album was inspired by a short story that I'd written when I was at school, which is bizarre. So she goes, it's in here. Let's go and have a look at it. So we went in, we had a look. It's this beautifully packaged album. It's called The Lovely. And it's a fucking gorgeous record. I was listening to it a few weeks ago, driving across the Mojave Desert after the conference in Vegas. It was just sublime. Anyway, so we're in HMV and there's Mara's album, The Lovely, and it's this beautiful packaging. And she's like, and I'm thinking while I'm in here, I should get Hot Buttered Soul by Isaac Hayes.
Mm.
What a record that is. And I can't find it. It's like I'm in this massive record store and they don't have it. And then you're just thinking, what kind of world do we live in? And Mara says, well, she said, I'm going to get you my album. I'm like, yeah, it's like cashback for you. But she got me another one as a gift. And she bought me the Pablo Casals EMI Masters recording of Bach's Suites for Cello and Violoncello.
Very nice. Very nice.
The one with the vinyl hiss on it.
Okay. Yeah.
I still listen to it. Like to the, I've got, it's on every playlist I've got, I think, pretty much, apart from the ones I listen to in the car, because the bass in the car disappears.
The cello suites, it is the gateway drug to Bach, as well as Toccata and Fugue.
Okay. I need to make notes. Gateway drug. But the thing that puts me off Bach consistently, I know this is going to make me sound like a terrible person, it's whenever the harpsichord pops up, it just annoys me so much.
Okay, well, you're not going to like my object then. We'll get to that.
Oh. Okay. Well, we can move. Should we go? Should we move on to books?
We can move on to books.
What's your first book?
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
I can't believe nobody's picked that before.
If I can have all of them, all five books in the trilogy, I would do. But I
there'd be an omnibus, wouldn't there?
There is an omnibus. There is definitely an omnibus. Although, frankly, the first three are the best. But let's not argue about it. I love that book. I was completely addicted to it throughout my whole teenage years. And the BBC radio series, which if you've ever listened to the original radio series, is unbelievably cool. It's fantastic. You can download it mostly, I think, off YouTube.
Okay.
And it's just brilliant. I mean, the film was crap. The TV was bleh. But the book and the radio series is where it's at. And it went on for ages and ages and ages because that's how it all started. And it's brilliant. But I will take the book with me, please.
Okay. It's a rock solid choice.
Okay.
And nobody that's listening to this is going to go, what does this man know about being stranded on a tropical island? Because what you've chosen there is a book that stands up to rereading.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Multiple times.
It is one of those things where you will get something different out of it each time.
Yeah.
And that's a rare thing. Okay. No argument for me. What's next?
I would like to take Emily Wilson's translation of the Iliad.
Ooh.
Which, for my money, is way better than the Odyssey, which is kind of a little bit... I think the Odyssey is just like ridiculously over the top. I mean, I haven't seen the movie yet, but I'm really looking forward to it. But the Odyssey is kind of like, you know, every single myth you can imagine and weirdo monsters. And it's fine and it's kind of fun. It's got the storyline is sort of a bit tenuous, but the Iliad is a completely different ball game, and it's just so intense. And it doesn't rely on magic and monsters, and there's minimal amounts of deities coming and interfering with humanity. It's just about human beings and how incredibly badly behaved they can be. So it's set in like the last month or so of the Trojan War, and it's just, you know, they're all angry and killing each other and doing really stupid things, and it's amazing. And I read it when I was at school, and I've kind of had a copy of it on my shelf and bought the Emily Wilson a while back, and I thought, you know, I've really got to take the time to read this. And then you said, I'm going to strand you on a tropical island. I thought, I'll take that with me.
It's a good shout. It's one that I haven't read. Obviously
it's amazing.
I'm aware of it.
I mean, it really is just like, and there's so many aspects of it where you think, oh, you know, you can think of lots of different examples from history or even in your own life where similar situations have arisen, because it's not barking mad with monsters with nine heads.
Do you like a good nine-headed monster? And it's a big summer for, you know,
big summer for Greek sandals.
Yeah. Yeah, I bet you they won't be wearing socks with them in the movie, will they? I don't care how fashionable it is, I still can't get my head around sandals with socks.
You need to go to Germany more often. In the winter, where they wear their Birkenstocks with woolly socks.
That sort of makes sense, because there's a property, wool has the unique property of...
It only makes sense until you actually look at them and yourself.
And then shedding water. Wool sheds water. Wool doesn't absorb water. Wool sheds it. In fact, all wicking fabrics are modelled on wool. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
True story. God knows why I know that. But I do. Okay, that's two books.
The last one is a bit random. So I'm going to take Niall McGregor's History of the World in 100 Objects. So I've never read it, but I listened to the radio series. And it's a really astonishing way of doing history. Because it's not the kind of, it's not your kind of narrative history. You know, I read a lot of biographies and you know, it's nothing like that, but it's an amazingly broad kind of survey of humanity and life through objects, and many of which are created by humans, but not all of them. Right. And it, you know, it goes from the obvious to the sublime, and it's just fascinating. And I think the thing about it is if you're sitting on this tropical island with nothing to do all day, you can just open it up at any page and you'll learn something amazing.
It's a very good shout. So I am fascinated by, you say you read a lot of biographies. I'm always fascinated by, I don't know what there might be a proper term for this, but I'm always fascinated by object biographies. I think there was a book called The Hare with the Amber Eyes or something like that a few years ago. It was very successful, and that was the story of this hare.
Hmm.
And one of my neighbors, actually, and a dog that my dog loves, they used to live just around the corner, but I moved house. They live just down the road now. The lady that owns Jaffa is an author, and she used to be like a travel writer and author. But she wrote, she heard a concert in the assembly rooms here in Prestine. It was a violinist, and wrote, it was so entranced by the sound of the guy's violin. So obviously, I say obviously, but all violins sound a bit different in a similar way to how old guitars do, but probably more pronounced.
We'll come to that.
She was so entranced by this that she was just asking him about his violin. And it led to writing a biography of this guy's violin. She wrote a book called Lev's Violin.
Okay. Okay, I like that, for reasons which will become clear.
Okay. You have thought about
it. Was it a famous violin maker?
That's a good question. Let's see if I can find out for you right now. I've got the book. It's downstairs. It's in my massive pile of books that I haven't read yet. Okay, Lev's Violin, an Italian adventure. Well, this does say in the Guardian review, the search for the origins, go away, of an exotic sounding instrument leads to Cremona. Cremona?
Well, Cremona is where the, you know,
home of the great Antonio Stradivari.
Yeah. But there were lots of, yes, I mean, I'm sure this guy wasn't standing up playing a Strad and not realizing it.
No.
But okay. Okay. Very interesting.
No, it's not. Greg reveals that auctioneers declared his violin worthless, little more than junk. So she wants to go and find out where it comes from. I'm going to have to read it. Apparently it is a fabulous book.
I would love to. Can you send me a link to that?
I can absolutely do that.
That's right up my street.
And the dog, Jaffa, is lovely.
Oh, that's nice.
Hates most dogs, but my dog's so daft and so big that she just went up to Farley, piled into him, expecting him to back off and all that, and he just stood there looking at her with his tail wagging. And then they played because he just didn't understand that she was trying to batter him. Good times. It's good having a stupid dog. Okay, I'm totally going to look up the history of the world in 100 objects because that is right up my street. That's really fascinating and a wonderful idea for both book and a radio series. That's really good. I do like that. We're going on to movies now.
Yeah.
And this is a tricky one. I have judged guests in the past, just so you know.
Okay.
Just kidding.
Okay. So my first one, in no particular order, is the original Blade Runner.
As in the theatrical cut?
Yeah.
Because there's been, there must
with
be
the slightly ambiguous ending. Yeah.
And the voiceover.
Yeah. And there's a thousand reasons for that. But, you know, anything that sort of Philip K. Dick genre, sort of high concept but beautifully realized, it's just an extraordinary film. And every time you watch it, you spot something that you didn't see before.
Unbelievable production design. Unbelievable.
Yeah, for its time, it was extraordinary. I mean, just everything about it, you know, was remarkable. Primarily, it was because I think it was a really great story and a great idea, well rendered. And a lot of the time, you get a beautifully rendered film, but there's nothing inside it, there's nothing underneath it, and it's just dull. But this isn't one of those. It's great.
I think most of Philip K. Dick, stories and books that have been adapted, most of them are at least a bit good. Some of them are excellent. And like, there's a Ben Affleck movie called Paycheck, I think it was called, that got absolutely torn apart critically and it didn't do well at the box office. It's immense fun. I mean, it throws out a bunch of the story. It's from a short story.
Yeah.
Screamers is another one that was totally ignored when that came out. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
There's loads.
I kind of ignore the reviews. Like, if it looks good, I'm going to go and see it, which I can do because I got three cinemas underneath where I live. So that's easy. But it's a question of whether you come back to something again and you get more out of it.
Yeah.
And Blade Runner is just one of those.
Yeah. It's a proper onion of a film. Mm. You can take it at face value or you can start peeling. It's got an actor in it. And I keep coming back to this in my head and in my life. I keep coming back to this and I'm really struggling to find the way into this. A listener to the Gambling Files saying like, why don't you try something that's more populist and less narrow, you know? And I'm like, I said to them, well, I've had an idea for a podcast. It's a movie podcast. And they're like, there you go. See? Yeah, because there's millions of movie podcasts out there and they're nearly all shit. But what I was planning, what I am planning to do, and it's taking me a really long time because I just make tiny, tiny bits of progress. The first replicant that you meet in Blade Runner is the guy who's being interviewed at the start, right?
Yeah.
It's an actor called Brian James.
Yeah.
I love Brian James. I'm a huge fan of his. He did, and I know people will always say, oh, Dick Van Dyke. Brian James did the worst Cockney accent in the history of voices in the movie Tango and Cash. I thought his character was South African for almost the entire movie. It's that bad.
Okay.
But generally and genuinely, he's brilliant, and he's done loads of genre stuff, loads and loads of genre stuff. His best known stuff is probably Blade Runner and The Fifth Element, I think.
Yeah.
But he's done some great horror, and yeah, he was in the first movie that the Coen brothers wrote, actually, a movie called Crime Wave that Sam Raimi directed in the mid-80s.
Okay.
And when James talks about Crime Wave, he's like, I don't remember anything about filming that because he was a raging alcoholic and loved cocaine. And he said, I was off my tits for the entire film and I really don't remember any of it. And he got clean and sober later in his life, and he spent his life, I mean, he was still working. He was still, you know, he still had a cracking career, but he spent it helping young actors who were getting lost in the same things that he'd gotten lost in. And he helped people get sober. And he died quite young. Mm. And I want to do a short, just like a limited series of like 5-6 episodes about people like Brian James who are a footnote, if anything, but who actually had a much wider resonance than their career might suggest.
Hmm. I think that's really interesting.
I hope so. I managed to find one of his brothers, but he hasn't replied to me yet. But one of his celebrities, that one of the more famous people that he helped, was Corey Feldman. He helped Feldman get sober. Didn't help him get sane, but he helped him get sober.
Oh, there is that.
Yeah. But it's one of my favorite things about Blade Runner is Brian James. Love that man. So listen, I've just got to throw in a story here, right? So one day I'm in the middle of Soho. I was working in Soho and I was talking to my flatmate Jules on the phone, and I'm walking along and I stop talking and she's like, you okay? I'm like, yeah, this is going to sound a bit weird, right? But I just walked past Ridley Scott.
Well, he would have been, said, that was not unusual because that was where he was based.
Well, Ridley Scott Associates is still in Soho.
Yeah.
She said the strangest thing. She said, oh, do you know him? And I'm like, what? Do you know him? Of course I don't fucking know him. Oh, how do you know who he is? I said, well, you know, as a director, he's probably, you know, shaped more of my life and artistic sensibility than anybody else at this point. And she said, oh, I had lunch with him yesterday. She used to work in a place that sold film stock, and one of their clients was Ridley Scott Associates, and she went to lunch with Ridley Scott and had no idea
who
he was.
Brilliant. I love that story. Shows how well connected you were to your flatmate that you didn't know such a thing.
Well, I think she just had no idea who he was,
right?
And
fair
was
enough.
Just like, oh, I'm having lunch with Ridley Scott today.
Fair enough.
Madness. Anyway, sorry, I got sidetracked there. Let's blame Fenton. Oh, that Fenton.
You can't compete with that Ridley Scott story.
Next movie.
I was going to say the original. I don't know that there has been a remake. War Games.
Wow, I was not expecting that.
Absolutely one of my all-time favorite movies. Because it came out at the time when I was getting into computers, so the first personal computers, and, you know, with a dial-up modem and hacking into systems that were where, you know, security was non-existent. And along comes this movie with this premise that was just about on the edge of being credible at the time. And great Cold War paranoia, all about the kind of the kid against the machine, and the, you know, the first love story and all that kind of thing, and, you know, even Nerds Get Girls too, which was also quite inspiring. And I just loved that film, and I watched it again recently thinking about all these conversations that we're all having to have ad nauseam about AI taking over, and do you have to have a human in the loop? And I actually said to somebody, oh yes, it's basically like War Games. that scene where they take the chairs out of the nuclear control bunker because this computer is going to be in charge of it, of everything. And then, of course, what could possibly go wrong? And it, I just, you know, it's brilliant because that whole computers taking over genre, which goes all the way through Terminator and beyond, all of a sudden we're actually living in that movie. Right, we are going through that right now, where people are deciding whether to take the chairs out of the bunker. And so War Games is a great film to watch right now. It's kind of amusing because it tells you that don't worry about it too much, just don't let them press the trigger.
That's so reassuring.
It is a funny thing though,
because it is very much a film of its time. I mean, it's you get movies around that period, and slightly before it, and they are dated by the representations of computers. The Thing is a great example of that. Alien is actually a great example of that. But it's, and I don't know that people do that enough these days, that they're able to, as a horror fan, I can look past the shortcomings of movies very easily. And find that little nugget of gold in there, because horror movies are never made with any money. They're made with passion and idealism.
And fake blood.
A lot of fake blood.
Lots of latex.
Yeah, often.
Yeah.
But War Games does kind of fit into that, because watching it now, you have to look past. I mean, it's a rock solid film. It's tense. It's really tense. It's a John Badham movie, if I remember right. And you know, Badham made some fantastic films. He did make a couple of duff ones, but only a couple. Famously, Saturday Night Fever was one of his.
I didn't realize that it was the same person. Yeah,
people forget. Saturday Night Fever is a fantastic, tough little film.
Oh, it's sad as well. Really sad.
It is. Heartbreaking. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now the sequel to that. Oh my word. Now we mentioned the word vanity. I can't remember if that was before we recorded or when we started recording. Now Stallone in Staying Alive would have been made in about 84 or something like that. Stallone directed it. And like, you know, directors sometimes put themselves in things, or they put their director mates in things, or in Hitchcock's case, he might put his shadow or his silhouette in something. Stallone pops up in that movie about 8 times, and each time he's bumping into Tony Manero in the street.
Yeah.
Seriously, it happens about 8 times, and it just barges him in the shoulder and just like looks at him. Vanity is not the word. I mean, it's just unreal. It's also a very wonderfully silly film. but oddly, this is going to... I used to edit a DVD magazine, and my deputy editor went over to... I can't remember the studio now. Paramount, maybe? Well, there was a party on the Paramount lot for the launch of the Grease DVD, and they flew him over to the States to go to this party. And he did some interviews while he was there. And for some reason, he managed to talk to John Badham. And Badham told him that they had to monkey with the editing in Saturday Night Fever because John Travolta can't keep rhythm.
What?
I know, right? It's mind-blowing. This guy's this legendary dancer, and apparently they had to keep speeding up and slowing down.
Love that.
To match the music's rhythm.
You never know what you're looking at. It's not real.
It's upsetting in many ways. And I hope Princess Diana learned that before it all went south. War Games, though. Yeah, that's really shocked me. But the timing, what was War Games like? 83, 84?
Yeah, 83, I guess.
And as you say, it's so relevant to now. Wow. Okay. Bring your third film.
So the third film was really hard. First two were easy. because there were a lot of contenders for the third film, and I was thinking, you know, what would I want to watch whilst I'm stuck on a tropical island with nothing to do? And I didn't want to go for another action or sci-fi. So I'm actually going to go with Chariots of Fire.
Okay.
Because I have a real sentimental attachment to that film. Just the, I have no interest in sport, but a very strong association with the lead character and what he, his life story and his journey.
It's a misunderstood. If you ask somebody in the street what it's about, they'd say it's about running. When in reality, it's a film that's largely about faith.
It is about that, but there's also a really strong storyline about defiance and putting science and objectivity above any other consideration. So it's a film about progress, actually, at the end of the day. Okay. That's really the whole thing. And it's been the theme of my life. And so, you know, I just love watching it. And, you know, once every few years it comes out, it's usually a good kind of Christmas Day movie.
Yeah, when you've got a trapped audience for it, did right kids.
Well, no, I'll go off and watch it on my own. No one else will watch it. That it's either that or Die Hard. But Chariots of Fire, lovely film, really, really nice. And there's, you know, it's about a world that really no longer exists, but all of the problems and the challenges really still do, and are worth addressing.
Yeah, it is a movie with timeless themes. Mm. In fact, all three of your, well, Blade Runner is certainly a movie with timeless themes. Just remembering, it was the Oscars in 84 maybe. And I think it was Michael Dealey.
Yeah.
One of those two guys, when they were picking up one of the Oscars that Chariots of Fire won, they said, "The British are coming, the British are coming."
Yes, and remember that.
They were wrong. They were largely wrong. And of course, it's a film that's really, really strongly associated, strongly remembered for that Vangelis theme.
Yeah, which is a shame because you know, it tends to be sometimes when a film has such an incredibly famous tune associated with it, that's all people can think about. Mm. But it is a fantastic film with a great soundtrack.
Didn't Vangelis also do the music for Blade Runner?
Yes, he did.
He didn't do War Games, though, as far as I know. I think that was
Howard Shore. No, that was, yeah, that was, War Games wasn't about the music.
I've got to know who did the music now, though. Okay, War Games, 1983 film. Yep, got it. Matthew Broderick, Dabney Coleman. Wow. He was great. Oh, interesting. Arthur B. Rubenstein.
There you go. Who?
Yeah, he's probably had a better career than me, but I'm going to go along with your who. Oh, yeah, he did a bunch of John Badham stuff.
Oh, yeah, I mean, there's movies like Flashdance, for example, where the theme tune was actually better than the movie, and the movie was like an extended video for the theme tune. But this isn't one of them. They work well together.
There is a tremendous book called High Concept, which is about the producer Don Simpson, who produced with Jerry Bruckheimer that idea of High Concept.
Yeah.
You know, you can say what the movie's about in about six words. And it goes a lot into Flashdance. And of course, British directors at that time were the ones that did this. I mean, Flashdance was Adrian Lyne, who's a British.
God, you're a proper movie nerd, aren't you? You really are.
I have been. But Lyon was a commercials director, like Ridley Scott was, and Scott's brother, Tony Scott. But Tony Scott and Adrian Lyon did more to create that visual signature around those movies and around the pop videos at the time than anybody else.
Right.
But Flashdance is it? I know people still talk about Flashdance fondly. It's an awful film.
Yeah.
It is a really awful film. It's a terrible film.
And it's there you go. It is what it is.
It's at least hilariously bad.
Yes. It's a bad in an entertaining way, in a really beautifully artistic, over the top way.
Yeah, 100%. But also, you know, if you say, I love sort of describing movies to somebody like, you know, the movie Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah.
Okay. So a friend was like, you should watch that. I'm like, what's it about? And he said, well, I can't really tell you what it's about, but it starts off with a kid selling his mum's television to buy drugs and goes downhill from there.
Which is pretty good. Whereas Flashdance is about a female welder who wants to be a ballet dancer. And lives in a whole warehouse to herself, which is quite something.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's
like Billy Elliot without manners, I think. Yeah, yes. Billy Elliot would have been mild. If I hadn't have gone for Chariots of Fire, I'd probably have gone for that.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. One of the most gorgeous endings of any film I've seen.
Oh, wonderful, yeah. Amazing.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we've got your movies. And they're all from a period of about 2 years between them.
Well, like most people, I imagine, all my tastes, your tastes get formed, don't they, in a very short period of time, and then everything else you just do on repeat.
Yeah, I don't know. I think aspects of your taste. I was liking it to kids. Kids, when they're young, tend to like olives because they're really salty. Mm. And as they get a little bit older, they don't like olives anymore. And then once they're in their late teens, they like olives again.
Okay. That's really not something that I've actually spent much of my life thinking about, but thank you.
The demographics of
olive consumption. You could write a PhD on that. I first saw
Texas Chainsaw Massacre when I was about 12, I think.
Okay. I think there's some serious issues with the parenting here.
Yeah. Doesn't matter. They're dead. And I didn't kill them, just for the record. Just to nip that rumor in the bud.
Just in case, yeah.
And I thought it was crap. And then years later, when I was editing that DVD magazine, there was a restoration of it, and it was reissued on DVD. And I watched it again, and I realized it was an absolute masterpiece. An absolute masterpiece.
Well, that's why it stood the test of time, right?
Yeah.
You know.
If ever there's a movie that's preceded by reputation, though, it is Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Okay. Yeah.
There is one moment in the movie where there is blood on screen. And apart from that, there's really none.
Yeah, it's all insinuation. And that's the genius of it.
That's the most beautifully photographed film. But as a 12-year-old, all went over my head. I'm like, get to that chainsaw bit. It's amazing that I've turned out as well as I have. So, you're now choosing one song. What's your song?
Peter Gabriel's So. There is a track on there called Don't Give Up where he does a duet with
Kate Bush.
I love that song. For every reason going, the lyrics, the tune, the voices, everything. It's like the perfect pop song. But it's a lot more than that. And it's also kind of an anthem for living. Don't give up.
It's a great album.
Oh, it's an incredible album. Absolutely incredible album. There isn't really a duff track on it.
Did you hear that story that came out after Ozzy Osbourne died about So?
No. Tell me.
This I don't know why it surprised me as much as it did, but I mean, Ozzy was a music fan, as most musicians are.
Mm.
But when So came out, he was obsessed with it and just played it on a loop all day, every day.
See, to the extent I knew that, I had something in common with Ozzy Osbourne, and now I know what it is.
To the extent that his PA quit because he was fed up of hearing the album. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary album. But there you go. That's the one track I would salvage on its own.
Nah, that's a great choice. Yeah, I love that. Okay. We're now onto one pet from any point in your life.
Oh, do we not go through the for the object next?
No, I'm going to go pet next. Wait, okay, we can do object pet. If you'd rather do object.
I have had a terrible, terrible experience with pets. I cannot do, never, ever let me be in charge of an animal. In fact, when I had children, it did occur to me that I probably shouldn't be allowed to be in charge of small humans either. And the reason is that all the animals I've been responsible for have died before they're supposed to.
Okay. Yeah.
Right. And it's not due to anything other than a complete inability to pay attention to them. I just can't do it. Anyway, so in the pet that I would love to bring with me was a tortoise that I had when I was, I suppose I must have been about 11 or 12, maybe slightly younger, called Horace, in the days when you could have tortoises. Lived in the garden, and I just kept forgetting to feed it. And I was a terrible, terrible, terrible owner. And eventually he just disappeared. No one knows what happened to him. I think he might have fallen in the bin where the dog shit went, or just escaped and never came back again, which I wouldn't blame him. But I, you know, any other animal I've been in charge of has not enjoyed the experience. So I'd like to try to redeem myself, since I have nothing else to do, by looking after this tortoise properly.
And they live a long time. So if you're there for a long time, it's
unless they're owned by me.
Well, obviously they're. Yeah. But in this instance, because it's a redemption, he's going to have a long and happy life.
Yes. Also, you won't have one of those horrible British winters, which tortoises are really not designed for.
No, no, they're not.
No, it was awful. I felt terrible. I still feel bad about it. And just, I'm not mad about the whole idea of domesticated animals.
Okay. And no, neither are my dog and cat.
That's probably what they think about you.
They just seem perpetually angry. Why aren't you just feeding me all the time?
Yeah.
Bastards. Okay, now we're on to object. What's your object?
It's a harpsichord.
No, it's not, is it?
So I'll tell you the story. My father's brother, late brother, was a luthier. Made guitars, violins, and harpsichords. And he was in Cambridge, very, very successful. Apparently in that world, famous, and had very, very long and distinguished career. A very long beard as well, actually. He and his wife lived in Greenwich Village for a long time. He did instruments for Peter, Paul and Mary, and he did lutes for Julian Bream, and you know, was really amazing. And of course, it was by far the most exotic member of my family. And he was commissioned by their other brother to make a harpsichord featuring in lacquer scenes from the family history. So the family's been around in the UK for an awfully, awfully long time. So most Jewish families came over as refugees. It was like big waves, and got a late 19th century and so on. So they were all expelled in the 15th century and then came back a couple of hundred years later. And my family on my father's side seems to have been around for a long, 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 long time. And so they wanted to make this kind of history thing. And so my Uncle David made this harpsichord. And then, of course, there was nowhere to put it. Right. And the thing about these instruments is that they do have to be played and they have to be kept properly. So they donated it to, I think, the Fitzwilliam in Cambridge, where I believe it still is. And the terms of the gift were that it would stay with the museum until one of the descendants was able to play the whole of the Goldberg variations on the harpsichord, at which point that person could have the harpsichord. So it's a bit like pulling the sword from the stone. And so I would like to have that harpsichord, and I'm going to do it backwards. I'm going to have the harpsichord, and then I can learn to play the Goldberg variations, which is, I know, back to front. But that would be my absolute dream. I told you, didn't I?
That I know is you the hate best reason that anybody yeah. could want a harpsichord.
Yeah. I got to tell you, I'm with you on them as well. I find them really quite annoying, the sound that they make. But a beautifully tuned one playing music that was intentionally written for it is actually quite good.
It's just inspired me to look something up that I've been meaning to look up for absolutely ages. That's it. Clavinet.
Yeah.
Clavinet.
Because the piano evolved, you know, like any other species, to what we know today. But, you know, you had various forte pianos and stuff. And a lot of the instruments that, you know, Bach and so on were writing for were those versions of those instruments for their time.
Yep.
And so what they thought they were writing and what it sounds like today on a modern instrument, two completely different things.
Yeah. I was listening to some Stevie Wonder and some James Brown. Mm. And it struck, I was listening to Superstition, which is obviously just fucking immense, immense song. And then later in the same playlist was Get Up Off of That Thing.
Yeah.
And they both have this really funky something in there. And I'm like, that can't be a harpsichord, can it? And at like clavinet, it kind of is the 60s funk harpsichord.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's then there's a Hammond dissimilar. Organ as well, right? I mean, that's something else. Love that.
Yeah. That always just reminds me of Viz, though.
Which is still going.
It is. I subscribe. They would do these one-off bizarro strips, like Nude Motorcycle Girl and things like that. But they did one called Captain Morgan and His Hammond Organ. And it just,
Very puerile.
Yeah, it's clavinet on both those songs. And it is this like really funky harpsichord sound. But yeah, I was thinking, I was sitting in the car thinking to myself, am I going to have to not hate the harpsichord anymore? No, I can just learn to love the clavinet.
Okay.
So that's good. Whew. I can't believe you've chosen a harpsichord there. That's blown my mind. And for such a tremendous reason.
It would have to be a good reason. Because you're right. Otherwise, why would you want a harpsichord? Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, because you've already got firewood.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, one of the things that he did was he traveled to Cremona and made varnish using the same volcanic ash that Stradivarius and Guarneri used and tried to prove that the secret to the sound of those instruments was actually the ash in the varnish rather than the wood.
And was it?
Well, it was a source of considerable controversy. And still is.
It's interesting.
They did a Pepsi challenge thing with it. I think they got Joshua Bell to stand up and play two instruments. One was one of David's violins and one was a Strad. Could you tell the difference? I don't know. It's a bit like with vintage wine, isn't it? It's like it's a... Can you really tell the difference?
They did a thing 20 years ago, maybe a bit more. And the culmination was about 24 years ago, maybe. They did this thing where... So most Scotch whiskey is... matured in a second use white oak barrel, right?
Mm-hmm.
So generally when bourbon is made, it's matured in a white oak barrel, and then those white oak barrels are taken to Scotland and Scotch is matured in those barrels. Occasionally they use a port barrel or a sherry barrel for a very different signature, but it's a second use barrel, right? And somebody thought, I'm going to make a whiskey that is entirely from Scottish materials, including the wood for the barrels. Everything.
Yeah.
Right. And obviously this took decades. And I was at there's a whiskey show called Whiskey Live, and these guys that had done it were giving a presentation on it. And I was there with Whiskey Magazine, who were the organizers. And I went in and I was just like moving some shit around or something. I don't know. And one of the guys said, John, come here. What's up? He goes, try this. I'm like, what is it? He said, it's the whiskey. And I'm like, okay. So I tried a bit of this whiskey. And I'm not somebody that tends to hide things.
Really? I didn't know that.
And it was all over my face. And he just went, it's really bland, isn't it? Like, yeah. He said, yeah.
Really?
Like, who would have guessed?
So disappointing.
But taking decades to find out that it's really bland. It's just like, I mean, I love this.
Well,
you've got
to ask yourself the question is, why were they using those other barrels in the first place? Aha.
Somebody knew.
Of course.
You often find in life that things, somebody already knew them. I saw a documentary where people were attaching these tiny trackers to bees so they could map their movements.
Mm.
And they found out that bees kind of know spatially where everything is around them for quite a long distance.
I mean, we have this in our industry, right? I mean, the number of times I see the same ideas going round and around and around in circles. And when the thing that strikes me about it is that the person that comes up with the idea and the people that give them the money to develop it either don't know that it's already been tried 10 times before and never worked, or believe for some reason that this time it will be different. And of course it never is.
Well, the bees, it turned out, came out of the hive and then flew in a straight line. And they were really shocked by this. And I'm like, but the clue was there in our language the whole time. We use the term beeline.
Okay, there you go.
I could have saved them a lot of time.
Shime, yeah. But then they wouldn't have got their PhDs.
Yeah. Maybe I should go get myself one of them fancy PhDs. Yeah, probably not. So now we're getting into the real bones of this. We're on to your dessert choice.
Okay. So I watched the episode that you did with my good friend Gavin Isaacs, with whom I share many things in common, one of which is that I'm not really a sweet sort of guy. But I'm going to tell you that my dessert choice is a traditional Edwardian dessert, Welsh rabbit.
Oh.
So if you are ever lucky enough, or maybe unlucky enough, to be taken for lunch to one of these clubs, gentlemen's clubs in St. James's, or posh places, or the House of Lords, or anywhere like that, they still serve Welsh rarebit as an after-meal alternative to dessert. And I suppose it's no different to people having cheese and cheese after dinner. So it's cheese on toast with Guinness or stout of some kind and a mustard. And it, you know, usually comes in sort of nice petite little Mr. Creosote sized squares.
Teeny weeny wafer thin.
And it's just really, really nice and super indulgent. And that would be my dessert.
Wow. That is new.
Well, it's not. It's very old, but yeah.
It is very old.
It's out of fashion.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm sitting here in Wales. I'm pretty sure I could go find it today.
Yeah, I mean, do you know, you probably could, but it's just one of those things that nobody really... It was of its time, right? And it's so it's a bit like they've just stopped making that fish paste stuff because like nobody buys it anymore.
Oh, the Gentleman's Relish.
Gentleman's Relish, yeah.
Wow. They've stopped making it.
No, they've just stopped. The company that made it has just announced that they're stopping it.
That's disappointing. Obviously, it makes you want to go and buy some.
Of course, but now you can't. And so it's very popular with readers of The Spectator, I've discovered, who want to have a campaign in Parliament to have it reinstated. But Welsh Rarebit is great and actually works pretty well with as dessert.
Okay. Sounds good to me. I mean, often you see Welsh Rarebit on a menu and they're actually doing fucking cheese on toast.
Yeah.
That is not uncommon, even here in Wales. Okay, that's interesting. Actually, my ex and mother of my children, she works, she's a chef in a really, really well-respected cafe in Ludlow, which is a place that's very, very famous.
Called Very Foodie, yeah.
And I think I'm pretty sure Welsh Rarebit is their top seller.
There you go.
There is a market out there.
Yeah, posh cheese on toast. What's not to like?
Yeah, seriously.
It's just eating it as dessert is slightly weird these days. But
no, I could totally get behind that. Yeah, I really could. Yeah, I'm on board. I'm on board.
Okay, cool.
I'll visit your island from my island.
For dinner.
But you're like, when you come to mine, you're going to have ginger cheesecake.
Oh, that sounds good.
That is fucking amazing.
Yeah.
God. Yeah, it's good. It's good. And you don't ever see that anywhere. But luckily, Fern's dad was a food scientist, and I mentioned ginger cheesecake to him, and so he set about the challenge of making ginger cheesecake.
And have you had David Kicks on the podcast?
All. No,
he's been around the gaming industry as long as I have, and he took me to his place just off the Edgware Road of all places, which does Basque cheesecake, and they're just like these kind of camemberts. They are absolutely extraordinary. That is really literally to die for, because I think it probably comes with a heart attack token attached to it.
That does sound right up my street.
That's very good. Very, very good. If anyone's interested, I'll find out or email David Cakes. He'll tell you what's the name of the places.
Okay. Next time I'm in London.
Yes. All right, we'll do it.
Now we get into the difficult bit.
Yeah.
Two pieces of advice. One from your older self to your younger self, and one from your younger self to your older self.
You're right, this is the very, very difficult bit because, well, for all sorts of reasons.
You also get to choose when you can give or receive the advice.
Oh, okay. That actually doesn't make it any easier.
Okay.
So older to younger is kind of easier. So when I was younger, so kind of up to my post university years, I had a habit of being very, very introspective and withdrawn for quite long periods of time, which really nearly kind of finished me off in my second year at university, where I just went into a really bad spiral. And so my advice from my older self to my younger self is just not to do that. Go out more, see more people, be with more people more often. It's not about not taking it all seriously or anything like that, and but you can't find the answers in your own notebooks. The younger to older, do you know what? I thought I'd just be able to come up with the answer to this on the fly, because I've had about 10 different goes at it. But actually, I think the younger one would say, don't forget to do more new things. I get a problem with it is you kind of get into a pattern, don't you, of life that you're comfortable with, unless it's disrupted by horrible things. And we live in such a disruptive era that the instinct is to kind of cling to what you know and what you're comfortable with, and the patterns of thinking and behaving that have always made sense, and they've done you pretty well so far. And I think my younger self would say to my older self, you know, just be ready for more and more and more change. Don't be frightened of it. I'm not frightened of it. Don't resist it.
But actually, I'm quite a simple person, just in case that wasn't obvious. And there was something that Bill Hicks said in, I think it was his last tour before he died, and it was about how it was the concluding speech. I think it was a Revelations tour. It was the concluding speech, and he says something along the lines of, we make choices out of fear or love. And that really has stayed with me for decades. And actually, I think fear, even if you don't recognize it necessarily as fear, can be an incredibly powerful influence, an incredibly powerful subconscious influence. But the fear of things changes, it evolves as you get older. Like, I could honestly describe myself as basically fearless until I was nearly 40 and I had kids.
Right.
And then it was like, oh, shit.
Yeah. Okay. I get that. I think actually it's, I'm not sure I completely buy that fear or love thing. I think what's interesting to me is, avoiding making choices until you absolutely have to.
And the growth in anxiety comes, yeah, an awful lot of that comes down to indecision.
Yes. Yeah, for many people, it definitely does. It also depends on the nature of the decisions you're talking about. But it's hard for your younger self to advise the older you, because the whole point about being the younger you is there's so much that you just don't know.
Yeah.
Right. And it's kind of what you're doing is you're reflecting on yourself at that point. It becomes a little bit self-serving giving that piece of advice. It's easier the other way around, because you can look back on the things that you did that you now realize were really stupid.
Yeah. If I ever do this, mine for that's just going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, or you could just simply, you know, that thing in Back to the Future where he takes back in time the baseball results, the almanac of baseball results. You could, that's probably the best thing to do. If you want to advise your younger self, it's like, here are some scores, go play some bets.
Invest in Apple.
Yes, invest in Apple. Just after the point where Steve Jobs comes back, that's when you buy.
Yeah. If you just go for it when I'm about 18. You know, I remember working on a Mac Classic 2 on my first magazine job.
Wow. Okay.
And I loved it. It was a great piece of kit. It was like, you know, invest in Apple. Don't worry about the ups and downs. It will all come good.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be nice.
I guess the idea is that you're 16, 17, 18, 19 or whatever. And you're able to look at your future self as a snapshot. You know, maybe you see your older self and you're wearing socks with sandals.
Oh, I mean, essentially the message from my younger self to the current self is just don't get too comfortable. Yeah, that's it. Always expect the unexpected, because it never stops.
I saw somebody did a diagram. It's probably some fucking meme or something. And it had you in the middle of, not you, it had one in the middle of a circle. And it was, this is your comfort zone. And then there was a massive circle around that. It just said, and this is where all the interesting shit is.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's another thing stayed in my mind. And it is like, especially like if you've got kids or young kids in my case, it's easy to stay with the routines. It's easy. It's safe.
Well, but there's a reason why we do it, because you can't possibly live in a state of constant change and anxiety. It doesn't work. Right? Yeah, it's the reason why we live in buildings rather than walk around the fields.
Do you like a good field, though?
Yeah. I'm not sure I'd really want to go back to being nomadic.
Yeah. Although I spent a couple of years, I mean, like just technically, a couple of years technically homeless, living out of a backpack. And I've got to say, it was pretty good. I mean, it wasn't great. Don't get me wrong. There were lots of things that weren't great.
Yeah.
But I moved around a lot. I saw loads of friends. I had really good quality time with people.
How old were you?
Let me think. 29.
Okay.
Something like that. 29, okay. 30.
Okay.
And then I got the job on Casino International. And I think I'd have been 31 when I got that. So it was like 29, 30. I was.
It's when you settled down.
Technically homeless. When I was, funny thing, Paul Ryder, the publisher, he was offering me the job and he says, you'll work from home. And I went, I might have a bit of a problem there. And he went, what do you mean? I said, I don't have one at the moment. He said, well, you're going to have to get one. Like, yeah, okay. And I did. And I moved to Bungie in Suffolk. Never been there. Just moved there.
Okay. Because it had a fun name.
A friend of mine had moved to a nearby village and she said, you've got to come see this town. You'll love it. And when Paul said that to me that night, I got online and I looked up rental properties in Bungie. And the first time I went there was visiting the flat that I then moved into.
Cool.
And I had an absolutely bonkers year there. And until I was run out of town like a common pygmy.
Really?
Why? Yeah.
Were you wearing the wrong colour trousers?
No. It's right on the it's right on the Suffolk Norfolk border, Bungie.
Okay.
It's like, you know, part of it's in Norfolk, part of it's in Suffolk. And I started a blog while I was there. And I did it as a writing exercise because I'd been reading bits and bobs of interesting stuff. And I've been reading about stream of consciousness writing and I was drinking quite heavily at the time as well. And I set up this blog and the idea was to just write something every day, honestly, something absolutely honest about how I'm feeling, about what I'm doing, whatever. And it was a period in my life where I was actually quite lonely as well. And the only rule was I can't go back and edit it. And this blog got really popular.
Okay.
And there were some controversial things in there, it turns out. And then one day I got an email from somebody. this is how technologically forward Bungie was at that time. I got an email from somebody saying that somebody was handing printouts from my blog around the pubs.
Wow.
And then the police turned up. As soon as I got that email, I just deleted the whole thing. And then the police turned up at my house. And I said, look, I'm allowed to have an opinion and publish it. And he cited a New Labour law, which was basically if somebody finds something you've done offensive, you have to stop doing it.
Oh, no, don't even get me started about that. It's appalling.
It was an anti-harassment law, if I remember right.
It's an anti-harassment law that has basically become a weapon for people to suppress free speech, whether you like it or not. What's being said needs to be able to be said, because the next person that gets silenced is you. And well, it's just extraordinary to me. I mean, there was a journalist who writes for The Londoner who was writing about the fact that some councillor, Green councillor in Tower Hamlets, I think, somewhere on the river, was trying to get the pub next to his house to take the tables off by the river because he didn't like them. And this guy was writing about what a ridiculous thing that is. And they got the police to go around and talk to this guy and stop writing things because this councillor had found it offensive.
Yeah, that's the law. So I got this copper on my doorstep, and I just said to him, I said, look, what I've written is published, and therefore it would be libel. And if they want to take me to court over what I've written, because it was one very specific thing, and I knew who'd complained. I had said that one of the local landladies had skin like orange leather. I might have described it as like a 1970s sofa.
Mm. I don't see why that could be a criminal action.
And I said to him, that's my opinion. I said, and there's that thing that the Americans like to call burden of proof. It's a civil matter. It's nothing to do with you. And if she wants to take me to court, she can then take me to court and prove that she doesn't have skin like orange leather. And good luck with that if she has to go to court. And that was when he cited this law to me. And I'm like, fuck off. So that went down well. And then I was walking down the street a couple of days later, and I saw somebody that I vaguely knew. And they saw me, raised their eyebrows, ducked into the nearest shop, and came out with somebody and were pointing at me. And I'm like, fuck this.
Time to leave. Okay. You're just a troublemaker.
Well, it turns out, yes. Yes, I am. So sorry about that. I've probably revealed more about me than you today. Sorry. I treat this as therapy sometimes.
It's very good. It's nice. I've enjoyed it.
Charles, thank you so much for sharing. It's been a revelation.
You're welcome. I hope that a few people pick up on some of these fantastic, but particularly the Keith Jarrett.
Yeah, seriously, I am going to go and
all right
sort that out now. Thank you.
All right.